Okay. You're listening, Studs, and I'm here sitting with Michael LaForge.
Hello,
Michael. We were trying to remember last time I chatted with you, which was a long time ago. And I think the first time I chatted with you would have been longer ago. But
I would have been early 20s or something, I would imagine.
And it's been really, obviously exciting to see someone's art change and grow and go. I mean, with you, it's also just going in different directions. And I've always been a fan of your work. I got a lot out of your latest book, which felt quite different. I don't remember every book I read, but I remember reading the last one. Was it The Holy Lacrimony?
Mm-hmm.
Which was more kind of a consistent through line of just a certain amount of whimsy, I want to say, if I'm remembering right. It's been a while.
Mm.
I can't remember very well. But this work, all the cameras in my room, it's very different, and it feels almost like direct and biting in a way.
Okay.
Where you're really zeroing in on things and being quite explicit in different ways. And I wonder if kind of in your own practice of exploring art in different ways and kind of how you've come to this book in comparisons with your other works.
Yeah. Well, for this one, because it's a short story collection, I do try to do some amount of editing so that the collections aren't just like, here's all the short stories I made in this however many year period. But in the process of doing that editing, I will find preoccupations come up, and that's ends up kind of shaping, with this one, with the last short story collection, which would have been Heaven No Hell, and before that, Western World, I think that was the one before that. In all of them, it kind of the book organizes itself around specific stories, I feel, and that kind of dictates what gets cut. And there's certainly a bunch of material in this one that didn't make it to the end because it felt a little, but yeah, I feel like things I start to hone in on what this body of work is about for each short story collection. I don't know if my process changed that much, but each one ends up being a reflection of what I was thinking about for that stretch. And I do think since the last one, Heaven No Hell, which would have been four years ago, that one was, it had a lot of dystopian elements, but as the title maybe implies, it was supposed to be a bit of a mix. There were stories that were maybe a little, there's the heaven part, a little utopian, or at least I tried to have a lot of grace notes in that one. And I did realize when collecting material for this one, they're not all bummer stories, but it is a little more pessimistic on the whole. But I felt maybe I was also due for a more pessimistic comic, because I tend to alternate between
is it pessimism or directness?
I don't know. I feel like most of my books, I try to be pretty direct. In some of them, they're extremely, Birds of Maine was one of my utopian comics, explicitly utopian comics. And that one, I'm very didactic. It's probably the most, maybe to a fault. I'm just writing it out, just spelling it out in that way. Holy Lacrimony, I think, was intentionally a bit more ambiguous, and then I just think this body of work ended up settling a bit more on the net. But I find I alternate a bit between that. I'll do the dystopian comic, I'll do the utopian comic, and I maybe need to swing back and forth to it almost is like a way to help me clarify my actual thinking about the state of things. Is like, okay, I'm like imagining things not being as bad as they are, and then also doing comics that are actually trying to honestly assess how bad things are, maybe is how I land on each approach.
One of the things I think of when I first open the book is basically like someone yelling. Even though it's saying all the cameras in my room, the first thing I see is just yelling. And it felt existential in a way, like that's kind of, and I wonder for yourself is kind of what, tell me about what gives you that kind of existential crisis feeling that you kind of bring through in your work, or maybe I'm just speaking out of my ass.
No, I mean, probably the same things that the same things that everyone is experiencing. I mean, this one is very like the sort of title story, all the cameras in the book, the title story is all the cameras in my apartment, and then I shortened it for the book's title. But like a lot of it's about surveillance, about co-option, about infiltration. It's like, I think, one of my more paranoid books. And I've had other paranoid books, so it's sort of like me coming back around to the kind of that type of paranoid writing. But I think, you know, like a through line that's been coming up a lot with my comics is that, like, this is an experience that like everyone is going through.
Yeah.
And I think that has helped clarify how I write about it. Like, that was a big part of Holy Lacrimony, and I think to a lesser extent, a part of all the cameras in my room is like the idea of that paranoia and despair and all these things being like collectively held experiences versus just writing it as like kind of individual in my own head comics, which I've certainly done a number of comics like that, where it's more about like an individual experience. I'm trying to like think of ways to like break out of that in a few of the comics.
Through doing personal action work that is collective in action, does that give you a different notion on how you create art with the collective for a collective experience?
It has informed my writing, and like it makes me write about, just in the way all experience end up informing my writing in some way. Like I changes the way I write about group dynamics over the years. I think that's very clear. Like I have a lot of comics about communities, and you can kind of see the same ideas worked on, like from Ant Colony to Six Angelica to Leaving Richard Valley to Birds of Maine to Holy Lacrimony. I think there's sort of like the way I approach community kind of changes. I don't know if I think about like writing for a collective, I guess. Like in terms of like my audience, I don't know if that's changed. Those group dynamics definitely like become a big part of it. And like in all the cameras in my room, there's certainly comics that like clown on certain aspects.
Yeah, there's a couple that really get into, like the one at the end.
The organizer. Yeah,
yeah, which was really fascinating. And it's just, it's almost like a John le Carré novel. You know what I mean? Where it keeps unfolding and the other surprise comes through, but it's almost also not about the surprise as much as about like that lack of power and agency we have at the end of it.
Yeah, I was trying to write more about, you know, because I am interested in infiltration but I wanted to write one of the classic things where, you know, it's actually less about infiltration but more about self-sabotage, or like the ways individuals and groups can self-sabotage. So that was kind of like a big part of that, because I also knew from the start, I was like, I want to write about like real dynamics and real tendencies, but I don't want to write about real things. Like I intentionally made it quite heightened. Like this is not, I don't think anyone, hopefully no one will read and think it's some sort of indictment of like an actually existing organization or organizing, as it's like, it is supposed to be kind of, yeah, heightened, spy-ish, cartoony. Like, it's not, you know, depicting something that someone could confuse with real life in that way. But
you're not making a commentary on the Squamish Seven.
It's, yeah, like, the whole idea is that it's more teasing out specific tendencies and specific, like, dynamics versus a specific situation.
Well, and I think about how when, you know, my own life doing a lot of community work and a lot of stuff is where you kind of carefully find that balance of where do you lose yourself doing that work, where that work becomes the definition of who you are versus the work being an output of your life of wanting. It's, I don't know if it's making sense what I'm saying, but
A little bit. I mean, my experience, like, doing community work and organizing and sort of all the things in between those, you know, like, yeah, it's sort of, like, it's kind of two separate things, but ways they overlap, and there's sort of a range of things in between that stuff. But I think one of the things that's valuable, but then one of the things that's very difficult is that it's, like, very ego-destroying.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, really useful sometimes and necessary to do that type of work. But yeah, like, certainly, like, you, part of it is good because you're kind of trained out of thinking about things in a very kind of, like, individual, like, that kind of, like, liberal way, especially if you're an artist, that, like, liberal way of viewing yourself as an artist who has some sort of, like, privileged point of view they're offering commentary from, or, like, wisdoms, political or otherwise. You know?
Yeah.
I think it's good to, like, kind of beat that tendency out of ourselves. And but it can also be very destabilizing because, like, it, you know, like, the ego-destroying thing can cut in a bunch of different ways. And it's also, you're doing that work under a certain amount of duress. It's very hard to sustain any type of intentional collective project because the, like, all of society is built to stifle that type,
yeah,
of, like, collective thinking, that collective work. So, yeah, it can be really, like, shredding and destabilizing in all these other ways.
It's really, I loved, you know, I'm someone who has worked in nonprofits for more than half my life, and I got a lot out of your nonprofit story in there.
Mm.
And I remember work once years ago, someone referring to, like, the industrial nonprofit,
oh, sure,
complex,
yeah,
as a whole,
yeah,
whole entity in itself, and it is a thing. As someone who's worked in a, you know, a senior level and,
mm-hmm,
in a pretty complex not for profit, you see how there's the work the agency does, but then there's the work the agency does, a state agency, and keep certain jobs going for people in the agency, which may not be,
yes,
filter down
to, yeah,
work. So it's I don't know if I have a good question about that as much as, like, it's I'm curious, as someone who's seen a lot of community work, is seeing kind of how, maybe this is a way bigger question, is the idea of how kind of peer involvement in things versus a kind of paternalistic,
mm-hmm,
approach. And I wonder if that's a piece of what you're thinking about with this story.
A little bit. I mean, but for that story in particular, like,
I mean, it's a funny story.
Yeah, I was like, I think it was more just about getting a laugh, you,
yeah,
know, like, and I wanted to draw some specific things. But part of it was a bit of a joke on, like, not even necessarily commenting on the entirety of, like, yeah, like, the nonprofit industrial complex or whatever. Which I, you know, I do obviously have, like, thoughts on, but, like, it was more thinking about even just how that stuff is, like, another language and its own ecosystem. And that was more just, like look how opaque and weird,
yeah,
this thing is. Like the funding and the functions and the processes, all the internal stuff is, like, so bizarre. And it does require, like, this, like, the ability to, yeah, like, speak a separate language to engage with it in any way, and engage, especially, like, engage it with it in a way that, like, we're able to extract useful stuff out of it, you know?
Well,
so that was sort of what the joke is with that book.
And that's on purpose. Mm-hmm. That is very purposefully driven. Like, I've seen situations where people like, well, and you use lines in there, but that's against our mandate and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, as someone who's written mandates,
sure,
and yeah, purposes, if you know what you're doing, you do it vague, so you can do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you use these things as a way not to do things. And it's, I'm always fascinated where, like, people are willing to step in and step out. And I think one of the things I wonder about is there a limit? I mean, this is just a non sequitur, isn't it? Like, the kind of personal altruism and, like, a breaking point with that. Like, doing our best for people and doing our best for ourselves, and is that reconcilable?
I mean, in my own comics, I try to make a lot of things about, like, there's no way to do it that isn't, like, everyone doing it together. Like,
yeah.
And I believe that, like, in real life, too. Like,
yeah.
You know, altruism is good. That's, like, a good, but, like, it's not going to be charity that kind of, like,
yeah,
gets, that fixes the real thing, you know, and it does actually require, like collective struggle. I do believe that very strongly.
Your story, there's a Wolfman story in this.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier while we're talking, you mentioned kind of, you know, revisiting things of previous. Is there any kind of revisiting of some of the work you did with the Sorority Girl by Night? And some of the stuff you're
filtering. I hadn't thought about that. No. I mean, only in just
let
the
me
very
reference this 20-year-old comic.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever been reprinted, really. I think only in this very vague thing of, like, you know, another thing that comes up a lot in this comic is popular media.
Yeah.
I think one of the titles originally was, this is going to be a Stuart Hall reference. It was either going to be called Popular Art or The Popular Arts or Cultural Studies. I had floating around his titles before. Both my partner and then also Tom Devlin were like, these are bad titles for a book. There was not a good idea to, like, title a book after another book that already exists.
Yeah.
It's also a very generic title, you know, so I figured out a different thing. But, like, the horror and the B-movies thing, like, that's just, like, a part of, like, the type of stuff I consume a lot of.
Yeah.
And so I do feel like my work frequently, like, cycles back to that. And, yeah, certainly that story, Universal Studios Monsters, like this book in particular is, like, a bunch of kind of film references and specifically, like, genre film stuff. So, yeah, it comes up. I just assume it'll keep coming up over and over again.
So. Yeah, well, it's interesting when you think of film in a way as, like, ways of popular culture, and I mean more historically maybe than present, although I'm not good on present film. I know you're much more conscious and deliberative of watching a wide range of current, but even, like, when you look at pop culture type films from the 40s and 50s and how there's, like, this, like, existential response to the Cold War and impending atomic doom, and how some of that kind of monster type stuff is, like, a response to that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I don't know if there's something there. I don't know.
I think a little, yeah, probably a little. I mean, I with a lot of it too, I mean, this, the organizer is very Burnsian in the way it looks, but I think of the way, like, Charles Burns, like, uses horror imagery, but it, like, just, like, what is it about these, Gilbert Hernandez is another good example of, like,
yeah,
what is it about these, like, images that, like, hold such power still?
Yeah.
And, like, I think the answer ends up being, like, yeah, it, these images, like, they're powerful. Even, like, the goofiest shit is powerful because it's, like, drawing on either, you know, like, all the obvious stuff about, yeah, like, collective anxieties, or like, it has some, like, weird psychosexual hold over you as a kid. Like, whatever it might be, and that, I think, frequently comes up. Like, like the, I have like the Michael Myers mask in that one. In the last book, I have the Scream mask. Like, there's this, like, certain images that have, like, yeah. And the, I also just pepper them in too, because I'm like a believer in kind of showing your work a little bit. And so when I'm like thinking, when like a movie or another comic is on my mind, like, I like it when I make the references very overt. That, like this is a very old collection, but the title, A Body Beneath, is like from the movie The Body Beneath, like a, an old kind of cheesy horror movie. But like that title, I was always like, this is, the movie's great, but I'm like, this title is like the, it's perfect. Although very few people have, I always thought like everyone would be like, hey, like talk to me about the movie. And I think,
I don't even know if I know the movie.
I think the only person who has ever caught it was Chuck Forsman, I'm pretty sure.
That makes sense. That tracks.
Yeah.
What was the movie? Now you gotta tell us more.
You should just watch it. Go inside and see. It's like kind of weird and campy, but then also like horrifying and very mean-spirited.
North American?
North American, yeah. Wait. It, you'll find it on Tubi. It's probably like 60 for, I don't know, 60-something.
Okay. There we go.
Yeah.
Good old Tubi. I mean, one of the neat things this book does is highlight your stylistic dynamicism in terms of, like, you know, a lot of different things. One of the things that I notice you do in this book that you really do not do often is really explicit representative figures in the Bell Let's Talk comic.
Oh, sure.
The Leather Daddy. Because it really, your figures are much more either formless, flowing, but that's like, this is a Leather Daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about that choice in that story, because that's not an accident.
Yeah. I mean, some of it's just like the formal thing of like, if I'm doing a, like if I'm doing a comic that's going to be many, many pages, I want to draw something that is kind of easy and I won't get sick of, like, after drawing 300 times. And when it's a short story, I feel like I have a bit more, like, all right, I only have to be with these forms for, like, 15 pages or something, so it's a little different. For that comic, I mean, there's a film thing, that's, like, a film thing, too, but that comic was initially, I have a friend who works at Crisis Line sometimes. We were talking, and I knew, like, they were going through something very, like, chaotic in their own life, and it was sort of a broad conversation about, like, oh, you know, what, like, is it, do you need to take a break from, like, is it too much to be going through chaos in your own life and then have to respond to people in crisis, like, and they were like, well, you know, you're kind of, you're, like, acting, it's like you're role-playing almost, like, you're trained, obviously, and even if you're not the best person to feel that sort of thing in that moment, you're, like, acting as though you are, like, it's like it's a, you're role-playing as someone who is going to be able to respond to this.
It's a tough balance of empathy and can't even think of the word right now, but when you're in that setting of how you can be responsive to someone with their needs without inserting yourself or taking over, like I'm doing with what you're saying.
And I thought that was, like, I was like, oh, it kind of gives me an idea for a story. But then the story was very, like, not a full comic. Because the joke for, you know, I had this idea. I was like, okay, someone calls a crisis line. And then what they get is the kind of, like, Bell Let's Talk corporate HR speak. And it's a very frustrating conversation. But then as the conversation goes, like, the person calling kind of extracts something from some sort of human response from, like, this corporate speak. And that was sort of the idea for the story, where I was like, this is only, like, a half comic.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of comics that goof on, like, that type of corporate speak. So I was like, it's not really there yet. And then there's a filmmaker named Joe Gage who, he directed Gay Pornography as Joe Gage and directed a lot of, like, kind of B-movies, like, creature feature type stuff as Tim Kincaid.
Okay.
But his films as Joe Gage, they're very, like, influential, classic, like, gay porn films.
And we're saying, like, 1960s?
70s.
Okay.
And he part of his thing was like trying to, you know, Samuel Delaney has that way of describing his like porn world, you know, where like everything is totally like frictionless and consent is just like assumed like that. And I think what was cool and what apparently, you know, I wasn't alive then, apparently kind of a big thing with Joe Gage movies is there, a lot of them were like working class guys and trying to show like how sex and sexual encounters exist simultaneously as like just the texture of their lives. Like it's like, yeah, like a lot of his movies are like, yeah, like I have a girlfriend, I'm straight, but like, it, you know, I'm driving a truck and like I hook up with someone in the bathroom or whatever. And it's like not questioned. And then also stuff where like things only exist in fantasy. This is a very roundabout way of talking about how I got to this story. But then,
it's then great.
Also talks about like the weird like fantasy stuff and what those fantasies represent, especially, you know, in spaces that aren't as clearly defined as like queer or straight.
Yeah.
And he did this one movie called Handsome that I don't think is one of his most well-known movies, but it's all dirty phone calls. And it, the whole movie is organized around dirty phone calls. It's people having phone sex and describing fantasies.
Yeah.
And when I watched it, I was like, oh, this, you know, this is such a fun and interesting approach to role play and like calling someone. And I was like, oh, this is what the story's about. This story's actually about, it's not about someone calling and being frustrated. The reason I wanted to write a comic about like someone calling on the phone was talking to someone who's working on the other line and end of the line. So I was like, oh, this is the comic. It's both a suicide helpline, but it's also like a phone sex line. Yeah. And you don't see the person on the other end. You're seeing the person receiving the call and how they're receiving it. And anyway, so it was like my roundabout way of like, that's how I came to that comic. It was like seeing this one Joe Gage movie about dirty phone calls and being like, oh, that's the comic. And I obviously wanted to reflect that visually. And then I think even the last line in the comic was taken from, you know, just in my collection of like paper ephemera. I have some issues of like old gay BDSM magazines. And the last line in the comic comes from like an ad for like a paid phone sex service.
That, okay.
I just had always had in my head is like, what a great line. And I was like, oh, it's the last line in this comic. I can finally use this thing that's just been like floating around.
I was talking to my friend, Jared, about this is, we're living in a weird time where you see this amazing explosion of really fascinating creativity of queer men in the 70s. Like, I'm doing this research in our comics, and I found this thing from Toronto called Butch and the Lavender Kid.
Okay.
You ever heard of it?
I don't think so.
It was in, it may have only been one strip in Guerrilla Magazine, which was like alternate newspaper in the 70s, but because it's from the 70s, likely that amazing work that this person's done is kind of lost to time because they've likely passed during the 80s. And I don't know if this is helpful in the conversation, but I'm really fascinated by digging up these lost ephemeral pieces of culture and trying to find and recontextualizing and saving it. And it's, you know, and it's done in such a way that like, being a gay man in the 70s was quite something. Like, it wasn't just, you know, I'm going to go be a gay man, but then also being able to create your art and do that. And so, I don't know, I'm really fascinated by the work that's come out then. And it must be, like, if you're collecting these types of magazines, you must be coming across some really fascinating writing and art.
Yeah.
That, like, kind of sits in its own place in time.
Yeah, definitely. But I also wouldn't want to posit myself as an expert, because it's more just, like, you know, I have friends involved in like the actual like archiving and collective. Yeah. And for me, I'm just sort of like, I just accumulate paper, you know, like, and there's stuff that's interesting. There's some things that I'm like looking out for, but a lot of the time it's just like, I'm just scooping up stuff, you know, it's much less intentional, you know?
No, and I'm not expecting you to come and speak to me about who did Butch and the Lavender Kid.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think like, I'm interested in how, ephemeral objects work their way into the present for you, and how these things filter through your writing process and your drawing process, and find a place, and how, you know, does that happen often? It's a seed of something, and it just grows from there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I with writing, I mean, that's sort of why I like the, like, showing my work thing is, like,
yeah.
A lot of my favorite artists are artists where you get to see them, like, thinking out loud. So I try to be very, like, yeah, this is what I'm thinking about, you know. And sometimes it's stuff from media, sometimes it's stuff in the world. But I think very often you can see, like, very directly, like, what it is I'm responding to or what it is that's on my mind. And then visually, certainly the same. Like, I like pulling from a lot of different influences. And a lot of my biggest visual influences, like, aren't just from comics, like, they're from, yeah, it might be from film, they're from design, you know, like, and all that stuff ends up working its way under the page in some way, you know.
It's interesting how you're someone who grew up in the age of the internet's always been there for you as a conscious adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
And you're active on the internet. During COVID, you had the film.
Oh, yeah, the Twitch
thing.
Twitch
streams, yeah. Yeah, you know, and, but you really, it sounds it's important for you to stay digging in these analog dirty boxes, and you get a lot out of that.
I think anyone who has had the internet be a big part of their life knows how inadequate it is, especially as an archive, you know, and it's getting worse, like, as you know this, like, it used to be a place where it felt easier to, you know, and there's still things where it's like, I can find, like, it is amazing, I can find any movie. It's like, I don't have to, like, find some real, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't have to, like, you can find a movie that would previously be quite difficult to, it's not going to be distributed in a way that is accessible to you, even when I was, like, younger, it's easier for me to find something like that,
yeah.
Which is amazing. But in many other ways, like, it is such a bad archive of things, and it's part of that is, like, an intentional thing of, like, it's whatever efforts there were to both archive things on the internet and then archive the internet itself are being, like, actively stymied. So it's getting much worse at all this, but like it does make me, you know, I'm not as ravenous a collector of physical objects of all sorts as I used to be.
You're running out of room.
Yeah, just, you know, a few moves kind of. But moving in with someone else where it's like, okay, someone else has to be subjected to, like, just what this looks like. I try to be, like, a little considerate about that. Even though I relegate it to, you know, like, my bookshelves are, like, in my studio space. I'm like, you don't have to look at what these piles are turning into. But, and then a few moves, like a few evictions is like, all right, how many times do I want to see this book and repack this book and unpack this book? Like,
yeah.
And there were a few where I was like, this is pissing me off every time I look at it. So, I've decanted a little, but I do still, you know, like, there's just some stuff that hasn't been archived on in a digital way, or some stuff that can't be experienced that way, like, it's just
touch, smell,
like
colors.
I think it's great to be able to read stuff online. I've printed,
yeah,
a lot of things online, but, like, certainly with my own comics, like, I make them for print, and a lot of comics I'm like, if I have the print option, I have a hard time, like, reading on a screen, and I just really, like, it's meant to be, like, laid out across two pages that I hold in my hand, so, like, that's how I like to hear it. And I'm a bit the same with, like, you know, I can listen to music in different forms, but, like, I prefer it when it's, like, coming from, like, my record player. Like, I still just have a few of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I bought a stack of records while here, and, I like the idea of getting records that are specifically from a certain era,
mm,
that have never gone digital.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, getting, you know, an analog synth album from 1979 that, like, if I got it on vinyl now, would not be the same object.
Yes.
Because it's been processed in a different way. And that might be really fussy and minute, and I'm fine to be made fun of about it, but it's also, it's a different approach to the art, and even if the artist wants to digitally remaster their work, that's great for them, and I'm happy for them, but it's still not the same kind of archival object, it's, yes, for me.
And I mean, that's a real thing. There's like, you probably know more about this than me, but like, I know there's been a carelessness with some of the, at the height of like putting out shit that hadn't been released as a record before, but it's like, oh, we have a chance to like sell it as a record now. I think it was like
CD masters used quite a lot.
Yeah, like I think someone I know at like some, I'm sure, paid way too much money on like a record store day for like a bunch of like all these Outkast records, or, and then like them sounding like shit because they were like, they just used like the MP3 files or something like horrible. And they just sounded like awful. Flipping. Yeah, because he played it and I was like, this does sound bad. Like this sounds like noticeably bad. Like,
yeah, it's missing the midsection.
Yeah, and I think like we looked into it. I'm pretty sure. I'm sure I'm getting the story a little wrong, but like, we looked into it, and it was like, yeah, this was like they actually did use an MP3 file. That's why it sounds so bad.
That is amazing. I believe that. It's funny to talk about ephemeral art and digitally archived, because for you, you're someone who, and I've talked about some other folks, not specifically about you, but like how the internet, especially comics that came out, you know, 2000 to 2015, say, are incredibly ephemeral. Mm-hmm. Things people have written. And for you, like, that's very much the case because your live journal got nuked by the Russians, I think, right?
I have no idea what happened to the account, but yeah, it became a Russian account. And I was like, all right. But I think anyone who's done this long enough, like, I still rely on, like, these platforms in a way that I resent. And I used to rely on them in a way I felt a little more ambiguous about. I was like, oh, you know, Tumblr, like, is a land of great contrast. You know, like, I can put a comic on there, and then other times people, like, yell at me all the time, you know? Like, so yeah. It's a... And I think anyone who's sort of, like, been through it, especially the musical chairs of it, like, yeah, knows how fleeting it is, and like, yeah. I'm very reliant on my Patreon. Like, I've been doing a Patreon for like 10 years, and it, like, I wouldn't starve if it goes away, but it does pay for a nice chunk of my rent. And I know how, like, there are ways that my income has sort of like waxed and waned depending on business decisions Patreon's made. That's sort of Instagram, like, I had an account suspended, and well, for Zionist mass reported an old account. And yeah, like that, you know, it wasn't like the most devastating thing in the world, and certainly you know as well as I do that there are like worse economic consequences that Zionists will try to subject you to than getting a social media thing suspended. But it did eat into my income in like a non-zero way, and it's like, the more reliant you are on these things, the more you always have to be thinking, like, okay, like, at some point I'm not going to be fucking doing, like, I don't want to be 80 and still thinking, like, okay, what's the new platform? I have to, like, figure out how to format
my
script for this, you know? Like,
where, like, I've capped out on my platform engagement.
Yeah.
You know? Everyone went to Blue Sky. Have at it. Fly away.
Yeah.
I'm just... You know, I'm that old man now.
It's very undignified to, yeah, like, have to keep thinking about it. Yeah.
One of my favorite things in the research I'm doing is meeting this 83-year-old guy, and it's like he's posting his comics to Flickr.
I mean, that's great.
Yeah. And then someone was like, well, yeah, because also he owns the copyright on that. There is no ambiguousness where when you're posting with these other places. So, yeah, like, when you're engaging with Meta, how does Meta control that? How does Meta AI take into that? And how does your work become part of the scraper? I don't know if the work cares about, the scraper cares about your work. But it's still, something gets in there, and that's that loss of your autonomy. So I'm being really negative.
No, I mean, it's quite, it's very bleak. And I do think of a lot of it, too, if I wasn't, you know, half my income is still commercial illustration.
Yeah.
And I do think if I, you know, I if I didn't have that side of, like, I don't think it does much for my books, you know, like, or doesn't do more than for my books than like D&Q just talking about it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's still the main way I feel like, all right, I still have to engage with like Instagram or whatever, at least a little bit, is because, it's like we're art directors.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, for some people it's getting to the minutia of, how does my Instagram page look? How have I done my grids? It's all complicated.
Yeah.
Makes me feel old. There was some specific things. How do you live in your own stories that you tell? How do you feel your place is in it? Like, some is more direct satire, autobio, like the cameras in my room. Some take on different forms, like the cheerleader at night.
I think with a lot of them, like, it's very clear when I'm writing in my voice. It's usually when I'm like, there's a narrator. It's usually just, that's just my voice. You know, Holy Lacrimony, Stunt, certainly some short stories, Familiar Face, Big Kids. I feel like those are like, you can like, that's how I speak. That's how I think. Like, that's how I'm writing.
Yeah.
And then it's almost that clear. It's like, if there's narration, it's probably just me writing in my voice. And if there's not, it usually means like, I'm trying to write like someone else might, you know. It's not like a hard and fast rule, but like, that's a big one. I think at this point too, there are characters in the comics I do with very large casts that might reflect parts of me. But those really are, like, I'm trying to write Springfield, you know, like, for Birds of Maine, for Styx Angelica, for Ant Colony, Leaving Richard Valley. Those are, like, Bloom County. Those are, like, Springfield. Big cast. And I really do try to make my own voice less present in those, because that's not what's interesting about writing that many different people. And there's also, there's a type of character I do, like, come back to that, it's almost like the absence of me in that character, like Styx Angelica and then the lead character in Brat. Like, there's a very specific type of like character that I like writing that is like the
impetuousness.
And like, there are parts of, like, you know, like I think the through line is that they're always very angry, and I'm a very angry person, but the way they manifest the anger is like very different for me. And that's what I like with writing those characters. So it's almost like it's almost like I'm writing about myself, but like in the negative space, because like I'm writing about someone who's like so reacting and to everything in a very different way than I would.
Do you get a certain amount of kind of catharsis from satire?
I don't know if I get catharsis anymore. I mean, I think with comics, I was trying to articulate this to someone recently. I've probably said versions of this before in different interviews too. It's like, it's so hard.
Bring up the line.
It's so hard to, but I think my thinking on it has changed a little, because I don't want to overgeneralize about, like, my process for comics is particularly fussy.
Yeah.
Or maybe not particularly fussy, but I'm in the fussy tradition of cartoonists where, like, I measure out the thing and I letter in a very specific way and I have this kind of deadline, you know. And that's not every cartoonist. There are cartoonists who are very expressive. But I think of, like, you know, there are even mediums I've engaged with before, like playing in a band or something. Or even working on, like, an individual drawing.
Think about your paintings, like the dog paintings you did.
Yeah.
You're like, they're very different from your comic art. They are not a comic page.
And I think with that stuff, there are other mediums where you can, like, there's a more clear, direct thing from, like, emotion to output. And then with comics, you might start writing a comic, like, in joy or in anger or whatever. But the process is just so fussy that, like, I think what this is, like, an asset for at least this mode of working is that, like, you're forced out of it. Like, you can't get that catharsis just because you start the thing and then, like, 18 hours later it's done. and it's just one page. So it's like you can't sustain that feeling of like anger.
Emotional.
Yeah. Like it was different from, like, you know, like even like performing a poem, performing a song. Like yeah. There are ways like it, you can have a bit more of that like direct like feeling to output. But with comics, I think what's actually interesting is that like it forces you to think about it with a bit more of a distance. And I think, you know, like clearly my writing, like it has this very like deadpan voice.
Yeah.
And part of that's just my voice. That is
your voice when I read your writing. Like there's certain writers where like, you know, it's like I can hear in your voice, and I know your voice quite well because mm-hmm. we've talked many times, and it works. Like there's some folks who I've seen, like I saw Austin English do a reading once, and when I saw him do the reading, suddenly his work made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. I see.
You know, in a way, because it's like when you hear that staccato of how someone would say something and stuff, it adds a whole other rhythm to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I think I don't tend to get the catharsis, but like it's but I'm also like, yeah, that's not what the comics are for. That's like, that's, I can get catharsis through some other thing.
Well, I mean, it's funny because you talked about when you were painting or drawing and in bands, and I feel like your activism work has kind of taken on that like other part of your brain that you used to put into these other more immediate fields.
Hmm.
And you've gotten like kind of more focused on that, or maybe it's just more visually noticeable as your activities are much more seen, and you're, for better or worse, recognized for your action. And I'm wondering, as like a creative person doing these different things, and how that kind of gives space for other things.
I don't know. I mean, I think this will sound grim, but I don't think the organizing or the activism or I don't think of those as giving me very much. There's some things I believe in, but like my they close space for me, and I think that's fine. That's a good trade-off to make, because I have political commitments that are more important than like how I feel about stuff.
Yeah.
But it's mostly doing stuff, you know, like the I mean, it would be easy if I could just be airdropped into places and I'm fine doing this. Like if I can be airdropped into a place to like just yell at somebody or whatever, like yell at a politician or whatever. But that's sort of like not the work. Like the work is all shit that I hate and have like actively tried to build a life not doing.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, I want to like draw in a room alone and then drink in a bar afterwards, you know, and then like the meat and potatoes of like organizing or activism, you know, like it's always just like being in meetings, like thinking about strategy,
making sure everyone feels heard in the meetings, and
yeah,
like compress after the meetings,
and editing stuff,
the meeting for the meeting.
It's all that stuff, which like, you know, I'm willing to do and have experience doing now, but like that, you know, I hate all that stuff, but like most people do. But that's just part of the work, you know.
And I think part of it is like, we were talking earlier about altruism, and years ago when I was a youth worker and I was wondering about how a youth was doing, and I talked to a colleague outreach worker, and they said to me like, do you want to know for yourself or for them?
Because mm-hmm.
if it's for you, that's none of your fucking business.
Yeah.
And I think it sounds to me like when you're doing this type of work, it's like, are you doing it at the end of the day so you feel better about yourself as being a better person, or is this the work that you're doing that you know you need to do with purpose, which is very different to me.
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, I think it's good that people can get other stuff out of it, you know, but like, I think it's also important that like to approach it with a certain amount of discipline, which also means that you're agreeing to do stuff you don't like, which is like a lot of things. Like, that's both most jobs, but it's also like your life is full of commitments that might suck. Like they might be familial commitments, commitments to friends, commitments to your neighbors or whatever, social commitments. And it's like, yeah, it's just a part of it. It's like you have political commitments, and sometimes that I don't want to talk about it like it's only stuff that sucks and offers no catharsis and I hate or whatever. But like part of it is like, yeah, you're doing a bunch of stuff you don't like.
There's a process to it. Yeah. It's not, you don't just show up and, you know, throw up a flag and walk away. It takes work to get to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, I do think of it as just something in my life to negotiate around, the same way everything is, you know, like the same way. Yeah. It's like social commitments, which are sometimes fun and interesting and engaging and sometimes like difficult because that's just what being in the world is or whatever. It's like, yeah, it's like that. And there's like kind of ways that it blurs, but I do think of it as something separate from my art and then they brush up together sometimes.
And I think like, I feel like we're kind of dancing around, but I think it's important to talk about is, because I mean, your name is very synonymous with it is, and you are the public person at this protest speaking in terms of the Geller Prize.
And, well, a one of many.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're the name that's familiar to me.
Sure.
Because I would
say I'm the organizer who is a cartoonist.
Yes. Yeah. So in cartooning community, it would be a familiarity to there. And the reason I'm kind of tying into the conversation, because it's also something that's not just about how our banks and foundations whitewash money that's involved in horrendous situations, but it's also because it's a literary thing, it's something that's active in your community and how we respond as a community to these things and how we allow these spaces into our rooms or these, I don't know, not using the right term, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so with all that stuff, you know, like I should say too, like that was kicked off, I was not involved in the initial protest, that disruption. Yeah. It was the disruption of the, and I can talk about the whole shebang because I assume American listeners don't know what the Geller Prize is. it is the premier kind of Canadian literary prize. And in 2023, there was a disruption of the live broadcast. It's broadcast on CBC or National Broadcaster. And it resulted in some arrests, and the disruption was specifically calling on how their title sponsor, Scotiabank, one of Canada's largest banks, at the time was the largest foreign shareholder in the Israeli weapons company, Elbit Systems. And then shortly afterwards, like maybe 2 months afterwards, myself and another organizer plotted out a campaign, because we were like Scotiabank at the time was sort of known as the Arts Bank because of all of its art sponsorships, and that's changed a little bit since then, but like a this actually is an opportunity to do a cross-sector campaign that could involve, you know, they used to sponsor documentary film festival called Hot Docs in Toronto, they used to sponsor a photography prize, or they still sponsor a photography prize, and also they used to sponsor a photography festival. It was the Geller Prize, and we were like, so we ended up getting a bunch of, so it truly was a group effort, like many different organizations worked together across the past few years as this No Arms in the Arts campaign that's the title of it, and in some cases that involved counter-programming, like for the film festival, like there was sort of a counter-program where it was using all of these filmmakers being in town as like actually a place to agitate and organize it around and implicating both the filmmakers and audiences, but then also, you know, going as far as the next year for the Geller Prize, there was like an actual boycott called of the prize. And I guess the long story short is that like it both resulted in some of those boycott demands being met, including by the Geller Prize, which no longer has Scotiabank as a sponsor, but also it dropped the Israeli Foundation and Indigo Books as sponsors to the kind of two corporations tied to Zionist occupation. And then as a result of, you know, not just arts organizing, but like nationwide pressure, Scotiabank is now not funding Albert Systems, or not invested in Albert Systems.
Divesting of funds.
It has zero shares in Albert, which is actually the only Canadian bank now that has zero. Wow. So it went from having the most to zero. And there are a bunch of different reasons. Like, it's not just pressure, but like in 2024, there was an interview with Albert CEO. And at the time, the Albert stock price was crashing. And in an interview with the Israeli press, Globes, which is like an Israeli financial publication, he explained that the reason the stock price tanked momentarily was actually because Scotiabank was divesting in such large chunks and credited that divestment to them being spooked about public pressure. Yeah. So, you know, and that's not just the arts organizing, but I do think that it was a very strategic thing. Like, we tried to never frame it as like just about morals or like ethical consumption. It was like, you know, we are choosing this because we think it's a vulnerable target. Scotiabank has made itself like the arts bank, and we can weaponize that branding back at them. So it was trying to like break out of just thinking of things like,
it's not picking every target.
Yeah,
it's not going at, because I get it. It's a focus, and I mean, when it comes down to it, when it's something supporting arts, but it's also to money, it's blood money, basically.
Yes.
Like, if it's, you know, the reason they invest is because they get money back, and that money was used to do horrific actions. And, you know, I'm pleased for the result, and I hope for more.
Yeah, I mean,
like that,
and the campaign's still going, but just not with Scotiabank, as you know, they wanted it to be broader than just Scotiabank, but that was kind of the first kind of big thing. But
I think, like, and for me as someone from Vancouver, one of the telling things of how money controls things is, Vancouver's a real estate city.
Mm.
It's all about building stuff, you know, and Emily Carr, the art university there, when they built their new campus, almost every major room is named after a different realtor.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And it's like, that's just like, and it's just like, these are the people that have made it impossible for artists to live and create in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby making hard art be hard. Did I get it right?
Yeah.
And students learning about art have to look at these names every day. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the whole charitable foundation thing, like, it's just like a rogues gallery of, like, mining scions. And like, so many of these fortunes have just been made either in extractive capital or real estate. Like, it's quite monstrous. Yeah.
Yeah. It's colonialism and capitalism at its best.
Yeah.
I was once at work at a work party, and I was talking to our agency CFO and someone that ran a finance program, and like, because I worked in very much frontline people serving thing, and so, Robin, what do you think would be the big thing to make a difference for people's lives? And I just looked at them straight on, getting rid of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like that answer. And I pulled it out for them. It's like, we're in a system that's based on exploitation of others, and the reason we have people in this position, like, there's things other than capitalism that are happening, including colonialism and interpersonal stuff. It's all sorts of stuff. It's complex, but I mean, really the pervasive need to capitalism exists on a ongoing exploitation of resources, be it people, physicality, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Back to a comic question.
Sure.
Is, I remember historically, you know, the stories of you kind of doing almost a full book and then scrapping it, and lots of stuff like that. And I wonder how you are with your process now. Is, have you kind of found the direction you want to go with your work with less false starts and more direct, I'm running with the story and this is where I want to go?
I still have a lot of false starts, but,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it looks different book to book. Like, Familiar Face, which I guess at this point is kind of that's like 6 or 7 years old. Like that, I like scrapped a third of it. Yeah. And I just think of that, like, that's just editing, you know? Like, I drew, like, 80 pages that didn't make it to the book. That's kind of just editing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, short stories that don't make it to the thing, and Holy Lacrimony, like, had a rocky path, but that was also stuff, like, the original comic for Holy Lacrimony had a lot of the same premise, at least around the way people experience emotions. But it was originally about a plague. And basically the way the aliens experience an emotions, where they don't have the emotional range that, like, grief and despair and stuff is sort of unfamiliar to them. Initially, it was a comic about a plague that makes it so that people can't experience those things anymore and start experiencing new emotions. And it was like a 2-page short story. It was originally in the Fader. It was just like a short, and I was planning it out as a big graphic novel, and I got pretty deep into it. And then lockdown happened and COVID happened, and I was like, I don't want to work on a comic about a plague. Like, it would be maniacal to keep this going. But I'm like, it's not really a full story. Like, that's just, you know. Yeah. But I have a full book that I made in lockdown that didn't get printed. Like, no one has it, I doubt.
I don't know, like, you see lots of people put out their books that are like their COVID books. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was good for people creatively as they think.
I mean, Birds of Maine, for better and worse, is a COVID book, and I think it really reads, like, I think in part of what I'm okay with anything just sort of being, reflecting a moment in time, but, like, I was doing that daily in the pandemic, and so much of it is, like, you know, everyone is just talking and thinking about, like, dystopia, and, like, that I made a comic that is very utopian. You can really see, like, how it's responding to, like, day-to-day stuff. In ways that when I read some of those strips, I'm like, oh, man, I wish. There's, like, a lot of,
where's that joy in me now?
The, like, kind of, like, show-don't-tell rule doesn't really, you know, like, it just, but, I just am okay with some stuff.
Yeah.
Reading very, like, reactively, you know?
Yeah. I think for me, maybe it's just my own bias, is, like, I spent COVID working in person.
Yeah.
And so, like, I can't identify with, like, the meandering humdrum stories, because it's, like, it just never slowed down.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, like, you know, I didn't have a thing where I had to work in person.
Yeah.
But I was doing, I did spend some amount of, like, you know, lockdown doing a lot of encampment work. And and I do think there's something about, yeah, there's something that I find very unrelatable about the way it's been memorialized as a time when everyone was indoors. When it's like, that was a very, oh yeah, it was like, that's such a specific experience. And that was a big part of my experience too. Like, I was fucking Twitch streaming and shit, but that was not a universal experience. And it really shows, like, who is allowed to make art and who is allowed to, like, memorialize and historicize these periods of time, where it's like when I think about that time, I was like, that was
strife.
That was time on the streets. Like, that was that was what that time was, you know? Like,
Yeah, like, you talk to anyone that was in Portland at the time, they have a whole experience of their own that's unlike anything else anyone, you know? Like, people getting ribs at the riots and just, like, a whole different type of activism. I'm really fascinated by Portland at that time, like, talking to people that were there and stuff.
Yeah, but all the art about it, like, you are right, all the art about it is about the experience of looking on your phone. And it's like, that wasn't a part of the experience, but that, no, it wasn't the lockdown experience, you know?
Yeah. My obsession in COVID when I was at home, and I think I saw somewhere that you're into it as well, as the Australian MasterChef.
Oh, I love MasterChef Australia.
It is unreal. Yeah. Like,
I'm a late adopter, but it's that they have, like, 4 episodes a week or whatever. It's great.
and it's like there's like 70 episodes in a season, and the whole focus is just making them better chefs. Mm-hmm. And, like, when they fuck up, it's like you see the hurt in the hosts, and just like, I want it better for you.
Yeah. I love MasterChef Australia.
It definitely changed a bit about like how I was cooking.
Yeah.
Learning from that and better at engaging different types of culinary. But then...
Who are you rooting for in the new season?
I haven't watched it in a couple of years.
Okay.
I've been off the grid with it. But I... At first I was like, oh, there's new hosts. And then I found out about the previous host. And I was like, oh, fuck those guys.
I don't even... So, I only... I don't actually know any...
This is like super micro interest, but I don't...
This is how late an adopter I am. I only started with the new hosts.
Oh, okay.
So I only sometimes hear reference to the old hosts and how one of them died.
Oh, I didn't know one of them died, but one of them was a restaurateur who it was revealed was keeping all the tips.
Oh, that sucks. I don't... Yeah.
So that's why they just totally scrapped them. They're like... There's no, like, it came out like how shitty he was to his employees.
Oh, okay.
And they're like, we need a whole new. And so now they have like, you know, the a lot more charm and interest. And you can see like a lot. Also, that guy didn't like spicy food.
There's still a thing where like they can't eat spicy food, two of them. But they will, but they like make a big thing of like how bad they are at it. Yeah.
I love a good spice.
I mean, yeah.
Thank you, Michael, for taking the time to chat with me.
Thanks for talking with me.
And I will say this has been funded by Canada Council. Thank you, government.